I just pressed the wrong button. I would say that because the subject of the book is why do bad things happen to good people and how does one react, it's not just another matter that comes up, it's the whole subject. So we have this elaborate introduction to present the subject in all of its force and all of its power. Is that the only answer? Is that a wonderful answer? I think it's a possible answer. So let's look at some of the sources that I brought. And the first one is from Tractate Shabbat. Not this one, but right, this one. From Tractate Shabbat. I'll just say shortly about this source. It's in the Talmud. Anyone can find it. I most powerfully was reminded of this source by the writings of Rabbi Professor David Weiss Halivni. Have I mentioned him? He is probably the greatest academic Talmudic scholar in the world today. He's also a Holocaust survivor. He's from the same town in Transylvania as Elie Wiesel. They were boyhood friends. It's called Sighet, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Sighet. They've known each other for 80 years. And Rabbi David Weiss Halivni, he taught most of his life at JTS. He left in the 1970s. Also taught at Columbia. He's one of those legendary persons. There really are such people that you can stick a pin through the pages of the Talmud and he can tell you every single letter that went through on 100 different pages. It's true. It's really true. He's a photographic memory. Now, he's an academic scholar. He's not a theologian. But he's dabbled in theology. He wrote an article on prayer during the Holocaust, prayer in the camps. He was in the camps. And he also wrote a memoir of his experience in the Holocaust. It's called The Book and the Sword. And in these writings of his, he mentions that it's this Talmudic source that for him is the basis of how to live as a Jew after the Holocaust. This Talmudic source we're about to see. And the source really is directly related to what we just read here in the first chapter of Job last week. So it goes like this. Rav Ami said, there is no death without sin, and there is no suffering without iniquity. And then he brings a proof text. How do you know there is no death without sin? For it's written, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. The son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, neither shall the father bear the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon him. It's a verse, proves it, that there's no death without sin. And then what about the next part of the phrase? There's no suffering without iniquity. So it's written, then I'll visit their transgression with the rod and their iniquity with stripes. It's a verse that proves that there's no suffering without iniquity. Now that's a classic, traditional, intuitive, religious statement. That if there's death, it's because you're being punished. And if there's suffering, it's because you did bad iniquity. And of course, it's about hashkacha klalit, take it back, hashkacha pratit, the assumption of individual providence. And secondly, it's about reactive providence. You get what you deserve. And there's statements like that, of course, scattered throughout the Talmud, just like I'm sure there's statements like that scattered throughout all of the religions that believe in a personal God. And there are many, many deeply pious people that based their life upon this both 2,000 years ago and today. But the Talmud says the following. An objection is raised. And this objection is raised, just like in Talmudic give and take, there are objections raised in halachic matters, there's objections raised in non-halachic matters, in Agadah. And the objection is raised from a braita, which means a source from the time of the Mishnah, from before the year 200 of the Common Era. And the braita says, it's the type of braita that we would call a midrash, The ministering angels asked the Holy One, blessed be He, Sovereign of the universe, why did Thou impose the penalty of death upon Adam? In the sense of Adam, the first man. Said he to them, I gave him an easy command, yet he violated it. So what is the Midrash saying? The Midrash is saying that why did Adam die? Because he sinned. Again, individual, reactive, divine providence. And the implication is, had he not sinned, he wouldn't have died. He would have been immortal if there was no sin. But he sinned. He broke the command. God caused him to die. But the Midrash, the Braita, that's brought as an objection to Rav Ami, goes on. But Moses and Aaron fulfilled the whole Torah they pursued, said the angels to God. Yet they died. How you can explain the fact that Moses and Aaron died? They didn't sin, say the angels in the Midrash. And God responds, quote, there is one event to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the bad, etc., he replied. Which is a verse from Ecclesiastes, from Kohelet. So that's the end of the Midrash. That's brought as an objection to Rav Ami. So in this Midrash, God responds that two human beings died because, period. Because that's the way it is. There's one event for the righteous and the wicked. In other words, there's no justice. Death is not a function of justice. It's not a function of reactive divine providence. It just is. That's the way it is. That's the way God set up the universe, that people die at the end of a certain amount of time. Not because they sinned. And that's brought, this bright is brought, this Midrash is brought, as a proof against Rav Ami. Because he claimed there's never death without sin. And the implication seems to be that according to this Braita, this Midrash, just like there is death without sin, there could also be suffering without iniquity. So at this point we have a good proof against Rav Ami. Then the editor of the Gemara says, no, Rav Ami can find a way to live with that. How? He maintains as the following Tana. Rav Ami can hold like a conflicting Midrash. In other words, if there's an argument between Midrashim, he can look at our Midrash and say, I just don't agree with that. I agree with the other Midrash. The other Midrash says, quote, for it was taught, Rav Shimon ben Elazar said, Moses and Aaron too died through their sin. For it is said, quote, because ye believe not in me, therefore ye shall not bring this assembly to land which I have given them. Right? It's a quote from the Torah that says Moses and Aaron didn't die for no reason. They died because they sinned. And it means, had they not sinned, they wouldn't have died. And the Midrash goes on to say, hence, had ye believed in me, your time had not yet come to depart from the world. So it turns out that already earlier, the Midrashim are arguing over the question of Moses and Aaron, did they die because of sin, or did they die just because that's the way God made the world? So Rav Ami can simply rely on the second Midrash and say, I don't like the first Midrash, I don't hold like that, I hold like the second, that there is never, ever, ever death without sin. Even the greatest human beings, Moses and Aaron, only died because they sinned. We're not finished yet. An objection is raised, another objection, another braita that's brought against Rav Ami. Four died through the serpent's machinations. The serpent is the snake, the Nahash in the Garden of Eden. Benjamin, the son of Jacob, Amram, the father of Moses, Jesse, the father of David, and Caleb, the son of David. So, through the serpent's machinations, in other words, not because of their own sin. They died simply because once upon a time something happened in the Garden of Eden, and God put into motion this matter of death. And it's true that most people, when they die, they die perhaps before their time because they sinned and God punishes them. But there's some people who just live on. In the end, God kills them, or they die, not because they deserve it, simply because that's part of the universe. At a certain point, you die already since the machinations of the snake in the Garden of Eden. So you see, this proves that Rav Ami is wrong. Because there are some people, at least four, that die without sin. And the Talmud goes on to say, which proves that there is death without sin, and suffering without iniquity. Thus the refutation of Rav Ami is indeed a refutation. And that's the end of the Talmudic passage. So Professor Harav David Weiss Olivni says, this describes what I experienced in the Holocaust. People died not because of their sin. And they suffered not because of iniquity. It doesn't say why people suffer, but it says that that hackneyed, traditional, well-known intuition that if you suffer, it must be because you deserve it, not so. The Talmud already 2,000 years ago came to the conclusion it's not always so. And therefore, certainly in the case of the Holocaust, although I don't have an answer, the answer that says suffering is always a result of sin, we don't have to accept that from a point of view of the traditional Jewish text. No. Of course, the text could admit that many times, perhaps even most of the time, people die because of their sin, but not always. And the minute, not always, so there might be a time, like the Holocaust, when it's never. Again, this is not an answer to any question. This is just saying exactly what the first chapter of the book of Job says. Right? Because we read the prologue of the book of Job, we know that his suffering is not because of his sin. So I'm just saying that this Talmudic passage actually reflects simply the opening of the book of Job. Yeah. Let's see another passage. The next one. And this is from Tractate Brachot, Masechet Brachot. Rava, some say Rav Chista, says, if a man sees that painful suffering visits him, let him examine his conduct. In other words, my first intuition, if I'm suffering, it must be that God is punishing me. Let's see for what. It's a message from God to look at my deeds, to examine my deeds and see what I did wrong. That's the first intuition. And then it brings a verse to prove that. For it is said, let us search and try our ways and return to the Lord. If he examines and finds nothing objectionable, let him attribute it to the neglect of the study of Torah. In other words, if I found no sin in my closet, no skeletons hanging there, but still it must be that there is one sin I committed, the sin of bitul Torah, of ignoring Torah study, because there must have been 5 minutes I wasted sometime in my life that I didn't study Torah. I just wasted my time, so that must be while I'm suffering. So you can always find something that you did wrong. And it brings a verse to prove. For it is said, happy is the man whom thou chastenest, O Lord, and teachest out of the law. Now, connection between being chastened by God and the law. Fine. But it doesn't end there. It goes on. If he did attribute it thus, and still did not find this to be the cause. In other words, perhaps I looked and I saw every single moment I learned Torah. And I can't attribute my suffering to anything. There's nothing I did wrong. Like Job. Let him be sure that these are chastenings of love. The phrase in Hebrew is Yisurim Shel Ahava, suffering of love. So in other words, this passage takes us through a certain theological process that indeed our first intuition, if we believe in Hashkacha Pratit, is that if something bad happens, it must be punishment. But that's not the final insight. This passage admits that sometimes that religious way of thinking doesn't work. Not that it always doesn't work, it sometimes doesn't work. And sometimes you look at your deeds and you examine your actions and there's nothing that could have brought on, could make you deserve such terrible suffering as you're getting. And in that case, this Talmudic passage says we have to look for a different theology. And a different theology is called chastenings of love, Yisurim Shel Ahava. It doesn't define what they are. But to use our language, what they are in a broad sense is proactive divine providence. Not reactive. The reactive didn't work here. Proactive. In other words, because of God's love for us, he wants to get us somewhere, wants to accomplish something. It doesn't define it here. But I would call it a move from reactive to proactive divine providence. And again, that's the first chapter of the book of Job. That you can tell Job until you're blue in the face, Job, you must have sinned to get the suffering you're suffering, but we read the prologue that says he didn't sin. That he was blameless and upright, And God brought the suffering upon him not because he deserves it, but rather because, at least the way I read it, because God has a goal. We'll go on with the passage. Rava, in the name of Rav Sahara, in the name of Rav Huna, says, if the Holy One, blessed be He, is pleased with a man, He crushes him with painful suffering. For it is said, and the Lord was pleased with him, hence He crushed him by disease. Another verse. Again, I'm bringing this for the book of Job. The book of Job also says, this will be just read on the board, because we understand that had God not had faith in Job, God wouldn't have brought the suffering upon him. It's only because God believes that Job could come out of it standing, alive, and with his faith intact. That is, it's only because God appreciates Job's righteousness and thinks that righteousness is so strong that it will survive. That's why God does what he does. Otherwise, God would have left him alone. If the Satan had said to God, you know what, God, take away Job's wealth and he'll buckle and he'll curse you, and God would have said, you know, you're right, that's what he would do, then they wouldn't have experimented, they wouldn't have tested him, they wouldn't have brought the suffering upon him, because there'd be nothing to prove. So paradoxically, Job, and I'll say this in language that I don't mean, just to emphasize the contradiction, Job is punished because of his righteousness. But it's not punishment. It's actually a certain type of reward. Job is rewarded for his righteousness with circumstances that will help him become an even better, deeper, more nuanced, more sensitive, more understanding human being.
It's not just a reward, it's more like a test.
I'm trying to be a little bit funny. You know, I'm using language, pumfarkat, and the opposite meaning.
Like Job's experience goes way beyond chasing, and it goes way beyond building character.
How do you know?
I don't know. That's why I started my sentence with "it seems." But I have a hard time accepting the idea of God killing off my children. You know, I might say, okay, do whatever you would to me, build my character, but leave my kids alone.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, surely we all have a problem with that.
Yes, we all have a problem with that, including me. Yes. So, let me say something about that. This is obviously hard, terribly hard. You know, in the ancient world, and I'm not defining how ancient I'm talking about, but certainly in the ancient world, children were considered to be property. I don't like it. To me, it's counterintuitive and cruel and wrong. But children were considered to be property.
Wives too.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And children being property was part and parcel of a larger matter, which has to do, I think, with things we've touched on in the past in this room, with the idea of collective identity. We are used to, in the 20th and 21st centuries, we're used to thinking of ourselves, individuals, as the unit of identity. Who am I? I'm Hanan Schlesinger, born X number of years ago, going to die whenever. I'm responsible for myself, no one else runs for me. I'm a rock in an island, if I take it to its extreme. And to punish me or reward me by punishing or rewarding my children doesn't make any sense, because they're them, they're legal, and I'm me. I'm someone else. But in the ancient world, it wasn't like that. identity, by and large, was not a function of the individual, but of the collective. And there were various concentric circles of collective. Right? If, in the code of Hammurabi, right, if you stole, one of your children could be killed. Same thing with a wife and a husband. The same legal unit. Sometimes it goes as far as the clan, right? One of the clan could be punished for what another did. The whole village.
It's still like that in some places.
And it's still like that in some places. And that can help us to explain, although not to swallow, of course, what happens with Job's children now. If I already started talking about this matter of collective identity in response to what Earl brought up, allow me to continue talking about it, not in order to answer the question, but to teach something else from it, to go a little bit further. To the degree that collective identity is the way that the legal entities are defined, and the way that people think of themselves, to that degree, individual identity is that much less stronger and less pervasive. In such a society that we're talking about, I don't define myself as an individual. The idea of an individual is not part of my consciousness. It's as foreign as thinking that my arm is separate from my body. As the Torah, in my understanding, searches for a balance between individual and collective identity. A balance. And as the Bible goes on, I mean from its earlier to its later strata, there is more and more of an emphasis on individual identity and less on collective identity, still maintaining a balance, I believe. And the same is true in human history in general. As the progression of time goes forward, there's more and more of an emphasis on the individual and less on the collective. A very slow process. A process that really began to accelerate only a few decades ago. Right? You probably heard me say in different contexts that today, one of the greatest challenges for Judaism is to maintain a certain sense of collective identity. In the modern world, in the postmodern world, most people have lost it completely. They're only individuals, a rock and an island, which of course leaves no sense of being connected to other human beings, to larger meaning, to groups, to communities, to religions, to peoples. It's being lost not only horizontally, sense of connection with other people in my day, but certainly it's being lost vertically. Sense of connection to my past, to my ancestors, and to my descendants. The biggest mitzvah, the meta mitzvah in our day, is to inculcate in ourselves and our children a sense of community, a sense of collective identity. Now, of course, I don't mean to go back to the situation we described 3,000, 4,000 years ago, but to maintain a balance between the collective and the individual. In my understanding, they're both extremely important. Without a sense of individual identity, there's no creativity. It's just being part of the box, doing what everyone else does, both horizontally and vertically. You need a sense of individuality for iconoclastic thinking, for creativity, for progress, for making the world a better place. But if you only have the individual without the collective, then the world become a better place, but there's no sense of meaning when you live in that better place. There's no sense of being rooted in a larger unit that's greater than you. So what we have to pass on to our children, of course, is that balance. We don't have to teach them the individual, we have to teach them the sense of collectivity. Why do I say all that? How is it related to our study? Because of the following. We've been talking about individual providence and collective providence. And I want to tie those two concepts to individual identity and collective identity in the following sense. Just like in ancient times, there was much, much more of a sense of collective identity than individual identity, so was there a greater sense of collective providence than there was a sense of individual providence. I would say that in the Torah, the five books of Moses, the earliest strata of our literature, I would say that the question of why do bad things happen to good people on the individual level doesn't come up, because it's very little sense of individuals to begin with. It makes perfect sense that bad things happen to good people because they're part of the collective. The collective does bad, the collective gets bad, everyone gets up together with them. The Torah isn't bothered, as far as I understand, by the problem of why do bad things happen to good people, because that problem arises only when there's a sense that the individual is an individual separate identity, and he or she deserves justice just like the collective does. It's only in the later books of the Bible, as history marches forward, when there's more and more a sense of individual identity, is there more and more demand for justice on the level of individual providence. That's the book of Job. The book of Job asks the question of why do bad things happen to good people on the individual level much strongly than it's ever been asked before in the Bible, and certainly more than in the Torah, because it's a later book at which time there's a sense that individuals are the unit of society. As far as one's consciousness, as far as identity, and legally. And if I have a sense that the individual is what's important, then the individual must be important to God as well. And I can no longer make do merely with collective providence. When the individual moves to the fore, then I start asking my question, why doesn't God give me, as an individual, justice? So in the book of Job, there's a deep sense of individual identity, and there must be individual providence and individual justice. However, it hasn't gone so far, the sense of individual identity, as it has in the modern era, in which children and parents are separated. In the book of Job, they're still one unit. And it makes perfect sense. And Job, he's been punished by the death of his children. And no one asks the question in the book of Job, well, what does children do wrong? It's like asking, what does my right arm do wrong when it's punished as part of my body? Okay. Okay. So we are now Atana. If anyone wants to stop me and talk about what we just talked about, we can stop for 5 seconds or 5 minutes or 5 hours.
Is there any historical evidence that biblical Israel was becoming more focused on the individual as the unit and less on the collective Israel? Or even biblical evidence?
Well, one thing that comes to mind is in the book of Ezekiel, the grappling with what was simple in the Torah. The Torah says that children are punished for the sins of the parents. And Ezekiel, a prophet, can't take it. He says it doesn't make any sense. To me, that's a development in the arena of identity. As an example. And again, this is not only in Jewish law, it's a universal development. And today, I would say that it's gone too far. Again, there'd never be modern medicine without individual identity, without a sense of creativity, without competition between individuals. But the pendulum has gone to the other direction, and we're in danger of losing all sense of moorings and anchor to anything greater than ourselves. Anyway, so Atana recited before Rabbi Yochanan the following. If a man busies himself in the study of the Torah and acts of charity and buries his children, and he does good things, but bad things happen, speaking of what we just were talking about, all his sins are forgiven. Because he got punished in this world, so that kind of cleans off his slate, right? If he had any sins, he did lots of mitzvot, right? He studied Torah and did charity, but he had some sins, so now he's punished in this world, that cleans off his slate. All his sins are forgiven. And of course, no one's saying, wait a second, his children? That's what has that have to do with it? No, his children are part of him, according to the way this is spoken here. Rabbi Yochanan said to him, I grant you Torah and acts of charity. That certainly can clean off your slate. And he brings some verses. But then he says, but how do you know what you say about one who buries his children? Rabbi Yochanan is skeptical about this idea that losing your children is for your own good. It cleans off your slate. It cleanses you of your iniquities.
Is that really? Could it mean the way I was thinking, which is that if something that horrible has happened to you, then who's going to quibble about sins? It almost seems like a quibble.
Well, yeah, and as God is not going to quibble about your sins and punish you for them because you already got what you deserve.
Yeah, well, you already got such a horrible fate.
But Rabbi Yochanan is not willing to see the death of children as some type of expiation for sin.
Yeah.
And I'll reveal to you something I might have said in our class a month ago, and it's later here in the same sugya. I just skip to the last nine words. Did not Rabbi Yochanan himself say, this is the bone of my tenth son? So Rabbi Yochanan had 10 children who all died in his lifetime. And this line here is a reference to the fact that whenever he came upon someone suffering, he reached into his pocket and took out the bone of his 10th child and said, this is what I've been through. So it can't be a coincidence that the same man who lost 10 children is the man who can't believe that losing children is somehow God helping to expiate your sins. Because I guess he says from personal experience, it's too terrible to explain any sin that I know I committed. And I think that also explains why Rabbi Yochanan had such problems with the book of Job. Remember, Rabbi Yochanan, we saw last time, was the one that cried upon reading the book. All the answers in the world don't make sense. He knows how bad it is and how real it is. And just like Job didn't sin and got what he got, Rabbi Yochanan probably says to himself, I didn't sin bad enough to get what I got, but I got it. It can't be expiation for sin. Another line from Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says, bodily suffering and children are not chastisements of love. Remember we saw earlier, Yisurim Shalahava, suffering of sin, in which we said, usually suffering is because, I said suffering of sin, I didn't mean that. Usually we say suffering is because of sin, but if you check, you don't have any sins, it must be chastisement of love. In other words, it must be not reactive divine providence, but proactive. Rabbi Yochanan doesn't like that. He says, bodily suffering and children can't be chastisements of love. You notice that that's the two things that Job got. Lost his children and bodily suffering, as we're about to read in chapter 2. And Rabbi Yochanan says, it's not punishment and also can't be chastisements of love. Rabbi Yochanan has no answers, but he is more comfortable living with no answers than with answers he can't accept. And it's not sin, but it's not reactive divine providence. It's also not proactive divine providence. He says bodily suffering, lack of children, is not chastisements of love. What is it? It's a question mark. Rabbi Yochanan again Doesn't have to answer. I'll just say one more thing. We said also last week, I think I said, Rabbi Yochanan is not willing to read the book of Job as a parable. I told you, I think, that his chavruta, his study partner, Reish Lakish, read it as a parable, as we're about to see. Rabbi Yochanan couldn't do it because he knew it was real. These things do happen. Rabbi Yochanan doesn't have any answers, but he's not willing to just sweep it under the carpet. Let's just read the source I'm referring to, Rabbi Shimon Bar Lakish. That's Reish Lakish, Rabbi Yochanan's study partner. He married Rabbi Yochanan's daughter. Said Reish Lakish, Shimon ben Lakish, Job never existed at all. Lo hayav lo nivra, wasn't and didn't exist. But then the Talmud says, reacting to what we just quoted in the name of Rabbi Shimon Bar Lakish, this view of Reish Lakish as the same person is self-contradictory. For elsewhere he said, the same rabbi, in the name of Bar Kappara, he flourished in the days of Abraham. What do you mean? Either he didn't exist, or he lived the time of Abraham. Both of them at the same time, the same person says it. Well, here he maintains thus. How could that be? He contradicts himself. He means, however, this is what we assume Reish Lakish really meant, that he, meaning Job, was never exposed to the suffering ascribed to him. It didn't happen. Why then were they ascribed to him? Because had they come upon him, he would have been able to withstand them. There was no such a person as Job. Take it back. According to the compromise, there was such a person, but he never suffered like the book says. It's a parable. What's it coming to tell you? That this person, Job, he could have suffered like that and he would have come through it with flying colors. In other words, the book is about, according to Reish Lakish, a certain man, Job, who really did exist, and it's telling you how great he was. And it's a parable, a fairy tale, that shows you this man is so great, even if he suffered like he suffered, he would have come through it with flying colors. But it didn't take place. And perhaps Reish Lakish holds it couldn't have taken place because God is just. But Rabbi Yochanan will not accept this approach. He will not accept that the book is a fairy tale. Not accept that the book is a parable. Not accept that it didn't take place. Because Rabbi Yochanan knows that it takes place all the time. He has the bone of his 10th child in his pocket. Rabbi Yochanan is Job. Rabbi Yochanan is Job. And Rabbi Yochanan knows that his suffering, Job's and Rabbi Yochanan's, is not punishment for sin, and it's not God bringing upon him suffering of love. He says it's not. It's just too terrible for any explanation. All Rabbi Yochanan has is tears.
This is getting depressing.
Getting?
Haven't even started.
What I would say is that our tradition and our forefathers have struggled with the same issues we've struggled with, and perhaps the comfort is in knowing that not only do we have texts to look at that might at a certain point give some partial answers, but at least that we know we're part of a tradition that is struggling.
Yeah, because even without Job, we still struggle with the same question just based on our own experience.
Yeah. So let's read a little bit of the book of Job, which we didn't do too much tonight. The book of Job. We didn't read last time the second chapter. We just got to the first, right? Yeah, we just got to the first. So here comes the second chapter. One day, the divine beings presented themselves before the Lord. I think everyone has, right? It's page 1340 in the English-only edition. Karen, I can't tell you what page it's on.
No,
got it.
Thank you.
Okay. It's right after the book of Proverbs. One day the divine beings presented themselves before the Lord. The Satan came along with them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord said to the adversary, "Where have you been?" Again, it's God's initiative. The adversary, the Satan, answered the Lord, "I've been roaming all the earth." The Lord said to the adversary, good to know that, bye. That's not what he says. God continues the conversation and says, have you noticed my servant Job? So who brings up Job? God does, mm-hmm. not the adversary. Have you noticed my servant Job? There is no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil, like God said about him the first time in chapter 1. And then God adds, he still keeps his integrity. So you have incited me against him to destroy him for no good reason. Right? The Satan tried to destroy Job's faith by taking away his children, his possessions, and it didn't work. Job maintained his integrity. And God says, he keeps his integrity. You have incited me against him to destroy him for no good reason. No good reason, the Hebrew word is chinam. In other words, you were wrong. And I was right, says God. My faith in him was justified. The adversary answered the Lord, skin for skin, which is an expression we don't know what it means exactly. All that a man has, he will give up for his life, says the Satan. But lay a hand on his bones and his flesh, and he will surely blaspheme you to your face. Now the Satan basically says, God, you didn't let me really get to him. You only let me take his children as possessions. If you let me touch his body, bring some evil diseases upon him, then you'll see that he'll just fold and he'll blaspheme you. You'll see it's not such hot stuff. You'll see that all his righteousness is conditional on the good he has, on the life you gave him, on the health that he enjoys. Take it away. You'll see. Now, again, who started this conversation? God. Who brought it up? God. And I'm continuing the train of thought from last week. I don't think this is the Satan baiting God and saying, if you let me destroy his health, you'll see what happens. It's God baiting the Satan. God opened up the conversation. God said, have you seen Job? God said, what you did to him was for no good reason. It's all God inciting the Satan to say what he's about to say, which of course is, give me another chance and I'll get him. The Satan is being manipulated by God, so in my mind it's all part of God's decision and God's plan to bring upon Job this suffering for a purpose. And God wants to do it in stages, not to get him at once with everything, lose his children, lose his wealth, and lose his health. It's in stages. First, we'll do the first stage, take away his children and his wealth. After he's used to that and he has the fortitude to suffer it, then God goes to the next stage and tests him even further by taking away his health. So God says, verse 6, so the Lord said to the Satan, see, he's in your power. Only spare his life. Give him the worst disease in the world, but don't kill him. The Satan departed from the presence of the Lord and inflicted a severe inflammation on Job from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He took a potsherd to scratch himself as he sat in ashes. His wife said to him, you still keep your integrity? Blaspheme God and die. But he said to her, you talk as any shameless woman might talk. Should we accept only good from God and not accept evil? For all that, Job said nothing sinful. I want to do two things in the next 15 minutes. I want to see the last source that I brought on the board, and I want to repeat things that I said in that class we had that only four people were at, the class about Job and Jonah and Yom Kippur. And both of these things are relevant to the last few verses we just read. So the source, not this one, I'd like to get to that one today, but we won't, I'm sure. On the other sheet, and this is a source from Midrash Rabbah. The Lord trieth the righteous. Rabbi Yonatan said, a potter does not test defective vessels, because he cannot give them a single blow without breaking them. Similarly, the Holy One, blessed be He, does not test the wicked, but only the righteous. Thus, the Lord trieth the righteous. Rabbi Yosi and Rabbi Hanina said, when a flax worker knows that his flax is of good quality, the more he beats it, the more it improves and the more it glistens. But if it is of inferior quality, he cannot give it one knot, but it splits. Similarly, the Lord does not test the wicked, but only the righteous. As it says, the Lord trieth the righteous. Two parables for the same point. A third parable. Rabbi Elazar said, when a man possesses two cows, one strong and one feeble, upon which does he put the yoke? Surely upon the strong one. Similarly, the Lord tests none but the righteous, hence the Lord trieth the righteous. So the reason why God takes away Job's health is because of his righteousness. Because he stood up to the first test and didn't buckle, he lived through the loss of his children and his wealth and still did not curse God. So he's proven to be righteous. And because he's righteous, therefore he's tested again. He wouldn't be tested again with a stronger test if God didn't think he could actually come through it.
I would think that would be a comforting thought if you're suffering.
You said you think it would be a comforting.
Yeah, if you could actually believe that, you know, the reason I'm suffering so much is because I'm seen as such a strong vessel and God is testing me.
That's what it says. And of course, this testing, although in the parable, it's literally to see if it breaks or not, but what it means for our purposes is not that God has a doubt if Job will come through it or not, but because God knows that Job will come through it, therefore he does it. Like here, there's a chance that the vessel will come through it. The potter wouldn't give a blow to a weaker vessel. He gives it to the stronger vessel because he's pretty certain it'll come through. In our case, God is completely certain that Job will come through. And so in a certain kind of paradoxical sense, the suffering becomes a proof of the righteousness of the sufferer, which of course is exactly the opposite of what you would think if you were looking at it through the eyes of reactive divine providence. If it's reactive, you would say the person's suffering because he sinned. But in this proactive way of looking at it, if the person suffers, it must be because he's righteous. And God is helping him to become more righteous, more nuanced, a deeper person. And we all probably have heard these stories. I can tell such a story because my wife is a cancer survivor. Of course, she would not have wished the cancer upon herself. But like so many other people, after having survived it with 20/20 hindsight, she says, I wouldn't have wanted to live without it. Right? If you know you're the stronger vessel, then perhaps you'd say that I need the pain to become what I know that I can be.
Those parables were closer to the way it is. I think it would be more comforting. And I'm thinking the first two are about things that don't have pain and suffering. They may be tested, but they don't suffer. The third one, I think if suffering was more like being put to the yoke, so that you were really doing something useful with your suffering,
mm-hmm.
that it might actually be more comforting
mm-hmm.
when you were just suffering and, in fact, were probably less useful because of your suffering. Like people who are depressed, people who are sick, people who have horrible illnesses aren't as useful to other people, you know, as or maybe even to God, I don't know, as people who don't have these handicaps.
You know, the Talmud actually debates that very point.
Yeah.
It's in a passage that I skipped. I put three dots. When it talks about suffering of love that God brings upon us, the debate is things that make us, yes, less useful while we're suffering, can they be defined as suffering of love? And some say no. If it causes you to miss prayer or to miss study, then how could it be suffering of love? But the conclusion is it can be anyway. Because the idea is, of course, that it's useful afterwards. It makes you stronger.
Still, it doesn't seem like very great motivation to do good.
And if you do good, you know you'll suffer, because you'll be worthy to suffer.
Well, I'll say this real quick, but I was discussing this with a friend of mine about a week or two ago, and he told me this little story about in his tradition, about a saintly woman who was pushing a cart through the rainstorm and kept getting stuck in the mud. She prayed fervently to God, "God, please stop the rain and help me, because I'm just can't get the cart through the mud." And just at that moment, the wheel fell off of the cart. And in frustration, she looks up to God and she says, "God, this is the way you treat those who love you. No wonder you have so few friends." And that's what I'm feeling as where we are in our discussion here. It's just very demotivating to, should we be so altruistic and pure of heart that we do good anyway, knowing that it might bring upon us the kind of suffering we're talking about. I don't know if I'm that good. I don't know. That's tough.
Of course, I hear what you're saying. But don't do any of you identify with the point that we really can only become deeper and more sensitive through pain? Or at least that is one of the major ways we become sensitive? I mean, I have from my own life so many examples that are so trivial. I'll give you the most trivial example in the world that just came to me. In the past few years, being here in Dallas, for a longer and shorter periods, my wife has been in Israel and I've been alone. And again, this can be very trivial, but I think the triviality makes the point. And in so many situations, so many times, I've been in situations, because my wife isn't here, that she's been in the past. And only now do I appreciate what she's gone through. For example, I'm walking home from synagogue on Shabbat, noontime, with 3 or 4 or 5 guests. And I'm worried, is the food going to be hot and is it going to be good? I never worried of that before in my life. And it was a little bit painful and difficult. And it expanded my consciousness. Now I know what she was thinking every single Shabbat at that time. And I have tens of examples like that. Just today it happened to me. Just today, look at this such trivial example. I went to Walmart, which I wouldn't do if my wife was here. And I was really in a hurry. And I bought my favorite drink.
Not
A&W root beer, diet root beer. Diet root beer. And I got home, and I took the 8 bottles out of the car, and 3 weren't diet. I made a mistake. I made a mistake with my own root beer. How many times did my wife make a mistake? And I said to her, "How could you make a mistake? It says diet, it says regular. What did you do?" And I sent her back to the store. And I made the mistake, and it's for me.
I wish you had told that story.
It's on tape. Right?
I'm already catching grief over it. So.
And I've been taught a lesson. How many lessons have I... And I'm learning so many lessons. Or completely different air. Again, trivial. 2 weeks ago, I had a sore throat. And it was painful. How painful was it? You know, but it was painful. But I so much appreciate my health afterwards. So much appreciated. You cannot appreciate health unless you've been sick. Fact. Just fact. Now, I don't want to have cancer, God forbid. But cancer survivors have a depth of personality that I'll never have. A depth of appreciation, of life, of health, of friends, that I'll never have. They're better people than me. If they weren't broken by it. Say it again?
Heard that about Holocaust survivors. Those I've known were Holocaust survivors. All said that. Couldn't help but wonder if they were rationalizing or if it was truly the depth of their soul, a valid statement.
Yeah.
Rabbi, this is something that I've lived with from birth. Being born with Erb's palsy. It's a birth accident. Came out 10 pounds. Mom was like that tall. Diabetic, so They had to pull me out, which caused paralysis. So here I am for the first 10, 15, 20 years of my life, wondering, what did I do wrong for this to happen to me? I didn't get a chance to sin, you know, and here I am with this issue. And then it starts to dawn on me that, what if I had been just like everybody else? And looking at my past and the area that I grew up with, the environment, all those things, I know that I wouldn't be in the place that I am now. And I'm in a much better place than even some of the friends that I grew up with. A lot of them I know are either in jail, doing dumb stuff. But here I am, challenging myself, college educated, all those things that happen, because instead of being with the friends because they could do certain things that I thought I couldn't do, then I had to figure out other ways to do it. Like something simple as shutting a door. You know, if I've got my hands full, instead of shutting it with my other arm, I'll use my knee, or I'll use my... First, my mom said, don't do that. I said, well, mama, what should we do? And so that began a journey for me to figure out how to do things that someone that didn't have full mobility has learned how to do. So I can do everything. Tie my shoes. I can tie my shoes. I don't have to use a Velcro thing. So all of these things started spinning my mind, and I'm much better for it. And I see other people. I see other people that are quote-unquote handicapped. And we have that kind of communication where they let nothing get in their way. And I understand that. And that's something that people that don't have a quote-unquote handicap or defect cannot understand. They can empathize, sympathize, whatever word you want to use, but they just don't understand. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know, what I've been thinking about is, we're talking about why bad things happen to good people, but also, why do some people not have, even in maybe just one circumstance, have the bad thing? Because I know, it's been back in the 1980s, I was in an accident where I would have thought, you know, most people, most of the time it would have happened, I would have been paralyzed, killed, suffered really bad brain damage. But I'm fine, and I was fine. So why? Why was I fine, and yet other people were, that I know, have been in things that were much less bad, and they're not fine. So why, you know, why does it go either way? I know you don't have an answer, but...
Well, you know, that is a good point, because you might just as well ask, all right, so some trust fund baby grows up, never has to want for anything their whole lives, and they absolutely are lacking in character. Well, wait a minute. Couldn't God have brought a little bit of adversity in their lives to build their character? Why didn't he? Because as soon as you say he does for some, then you're right. You've got to ask the question, why didn't he for someone else?
Yeah.
I can't help noticing you're not answering.
Well, I think you're making the assumption that because they have money, that's a good thing. And
I think I was arguing just the opposite.
Yeah, you're saying...
That why was this person...
So unfortunate to be so rich.
To never have adversity, to build character.
But by the same token, you can also say, and there are umpteen examples of it, of people who do have wealth, but they've got their head screwed on, and they've got their value system, and they teach their kids, okay, the right way. Mm-hmm. And they're not spoiled. I mean, just as we were driving over, as I was driving over here, I was listening to a guy on the radio, and he was talking about this judge, you probably read about it or heard about it, who had beaten a 16-year-old daughter, and this all went on YouTube.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, apparently, the daughter was getting back at her father, kind of like a bribe, okay, because he was taking away a little bit of the lifestyle that she'd grown accustomed to, her Mercedes, and all, 16 years old at the time, okay? Mm. So here's an example of obviously a father who had a pretty bad habit of corporal punishment, but by the same token, had absolutely no parenting skills whatsoever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And no leadership qualities, no teaching qualities, just, you know, basically gave everything. And then when she admitted, or he found out that she had been stealing, you know, he just lost it. But, you know, there are umpteen examples of doing good and doing bad, and I think it all still comes down to parenting. We've lost that skill in this, certainly in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but that's still precisely the point I make.
Yeah.
Is that if either way you play the game, that whatever it is that God does that's good for you, He doesn't do the same for everybody. So whether you say adversity is good or say the lack of adversity is good, you're still stuck with the dilemma that some people do and some people don't.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's disturbing.
Yes, that's why we're here, to be disturbed.
Oh. I know that's why I came.